Radio Gorgeous.
Went back to Napoli because he missed the scenery, the native dances and the charming songs. But wait a minute.
Catherine Wilson, welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
We are here for the publication of your book, Only in Naples.
Yes.
You were a young American girl, went off for adventure, as they say in French, faire un stage, you know, in Italy. So you're sort of sent off to be finished.
Yes, in a way.
Mm. Tell us about that. Tell us about your upbringing. We get a picture of you.
I was raised in Washington, D.C., and in my family, there was sort of the tradition of doing an experience abroad. So it wasn't exactly the grand tour of Once Upon a Time, but it was learn a language, meet new people, have different experiences, and then come back home and get going on your real life. I never came home.
None of this is real life as far as your parents are concerned. None of this happened.
This isn't, let's just say, they expected the Italian chapter of my life to be short and sweet, maybe learn some recipes and learn Italian, but then to come back home to New York or Washington and have a career. That was 20 years ago. I never went home.
Exactly. It was sort of like in England, you know, have your holiday, your romance, your Sherry Valentine moment, and then come back, get on with life.
Exactly, exactly.
But you fell in love first with your future mother-in-law.
Yes, believe it or not.
How did you meet the Avellones, and in particular Raffaella Avellone?
Well, I was doing an internship at the American Consulate in Naples, and the consul general's wife was a Neapolitan signora who moved in Neapolitan society and knew that the woman who really got things done when it was time for gala or benefit was Raffaella Avellone. So she said, there's this girl, this young American girl who doesn't know anyone, who's just arrived in Naples. Can you get your children to show her around? And Raffaella, as soon as she hears that someone is in need of help or a sistemazione, a setup, she gets herself moving. So she found me a place to live, and she told her son, Salvatore, that there was a girl that he was to call. And she said, show her the town, take her around, bring her to the best pizzeria in Naples. He decided, instead of that, to bring me home to his mamma and papa. So that was the beginning of a love affair, not only with him, but with his family and with their whole culture.
The first thing that struck me in reading your memoir, Only in Naples, was that we have such preconceived notions of the place and our own perspectives. For example, for me, living in England, it took me a long time to realize that people can actually die of embarrassment. Like, it's actually possible for an Englishman, and I swear to God, some have. It's anathema to me because I wasn't born with that, an embarrassed gene. Like, it doesn't exist. But for that, you know, so you see things through your own American eyes, your own East Coast American eyes, your own very well-to-do, highly educated American eyes, and you know, how you perceive this culture of, like, you're taking me to your mother's house? Like,
yes.
What's wrong with you?
Red flags, alarm bells. This guy is not independent. He's dependent on his mother. He's a mama's boy. Stay away. And then she, I'm not going to say seduced me, but she spoon-fed me and loved me in the way that she spoon-fed and loved her son. And I saw that I needed it as much as he did, if not more.
This was a wonderful concept that you introduced very early on in the book. Because you came, you have food issues. You have a complicated relationship with food, with your body. You see those as separate. There's the thin you, the fat you, the head, the body. And you slowly, spoon by spoon, are taught to be carnale.
Yes.
And bringing them all together in one, in your body, living from the inside out. Tell us that journey.
Absolutely. That's just the center of Neapolitan culture, is this idea of carnale, of living in your body with ease and confidence and celebrating your appetites. I feel like in my own East Coast upbringing, there was very much the sense that your appetites were something to be managed and controlled, usually suppressed. And then I got to Naples and I saw a place where if you were hungry, it was a beautiful thing and you were meant to be satisfied, and that the body itself was celebrated in a way that in my Anglo-Saxon culture, it wasn't. It was very healing, the whole culture, and specifically that family.
That's what I mean, that you really dropped your own perceptions and perspective in that way. And from the outside, Italian culture can look like a woman is stuck in the home. Whereas you really saw it as, that woman rules half of Italy from her kitchen, you know? Like, you really realize that this is not what it looks like from the outside.
Yes. I often thought before I moved to Italy of gender roles in Latin, more traditional Latin cultures, and judged them. But when I got to Italy, I couldn't find the victims. I saw that the home was the center of power and of life. I saw a matriarchy, because Naples is a matriarchy. And I realized I had so much to learn from that. And there's also, I realized how much judgment there was in my background. Judging others, judging your body, judging yourself and your decisions. And my mother-in-law does not have a judgmental bone in her body. So when I had that as a mentor, I realized, what am I doing? Judging my appetites and my body and my choices and my life as a woman. I've got to follow this example.
And follow it you did.
Darling, I only listen to Radio Gorgeous. Uh-huh.
Your initial time in Naples was limited, and so you had to do other things and develop other parts of yourself and other parts of Italy. Tell me a little bit about your journey through Italy.
Well, I've always loved theater. It's the passion of my life. So I was so young when I moved to Naples that I thought, I want to try to act in the place that I love. So I started auditioning in Italy and did tours of musical theater as well as dubbing, which is very different from Anglo-Saxon. The arts in the United States or probably in the UK. But I found that there was always the pull of Naples, that had become home to me in a way, in a visceral way. It was my body that realized it, probably before my brain did, just like when I go back to the States. And all of a sudden, the sounds of Italy, the smells, the tastes, the beauty, my body needs it at this point.
Italy is a young country. It's only been unified in name only, really.
Yes.
To the outside, it's unified. Internally, there, you know, the city-states remain judgmentally separate, at least. And some of the things, you know, these Neapolitan stereotypes, you must relate how people from Naples ski. That took me as the most hilarious, like bump fight down a mountain.
Bump fight down a mountain. Oh, it's petrifying. It is so scary. But the first thing about it is that they look so professional and experienced and gorgeous that you think, well, of course, these people are expert slalom downhill racers. And then they get on the slopes and they literally snowplow or pizza pie straight down the mountain as they talk on their phones or take pictures. Or it's like a lot of people have seen driving in Italy to the extreme. Skiing is that to the extreme. But they look fabulous as they do it.
Done with style.
Exactly.
And it's all about getting to the, where are we going for lunch?
Right.
That's entire the, exercise.
The destination. I realized that in the States, when we would go to Colorado and ski, we would grab a burger or a bowl of chili and then get back on the slopes. In Italy, the place that you eat is the destination. So skiing is a mode of transport to get you there to have your divine lunch.
And like any other mode of transport, like however you get there is fine.
Exactly.
Fast is best.
Yes. You know?
Well, there's this other tradition which strikes me as very funny, because as an American, I know, you know, WASPy, exactly, yes. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant, and just the whole concept, fidarsi a bene, non fidarsi e meglio.
Brava, esatto, that's right.
But to trust is, yeah, that's good, that's nice. Not to trust is a hell of a lot better.
Exactly.
You know, way better, way exactly. safer, you know. But as, I mean, you know, I am living in London now. I feel like I need to go to New York every once in a while, because I'm softening. I'm becoming too nice, you know, too polite. I'm waiting for people to go, oh, please go in front of me and whatever. By now, I'd be completely lost in Naples, you know.
It is just fight for yourself and your loved ones and elbow anybody else out. Lie if you need to. It's so different, and it's hard, particularly when it comes to child rearing, because we Americans have put such an emphasis on the truth and telling the truth, and George Washington never told a lie. And in Naples, they really take pride in children who are able to unmask people who are trying to dupe them. So the idea is you want a child who is sveglio, who's awake, who has 1,000 eyes, who realizes who's trying to pull one over on him, and that's what you're proudest of. You're not proudest of your child who tells the truth and waits in line and does well in school, because they say, what's that kid going to do in the real world?
He's going to
be eaten. Exactly. He's going to be eaten alive, so you better. And so they will even tell lies, recreate the truth to children, so that children get used to that lesson and learn how to do it.
Well, I would say that was tantamount to what we call emotional intelligence, you know, as opposed to, you know, IQ. It's like, well, who's savvy?
Exactly. You know? Street smart, savvy.
Yeah, exactly. A survivor. That's what you want.
Yes.
You're not going to be around. They need to survive.
Exactly. And when you live in a city like Naples that has the history that Naples has had, that is survival.
That does bring up one thing, because it's one thing for you yourself to accommodate the different sides of you. But as you say, then you're bringing up children. And that brings up a different level of self-examination and what you think is the right thing to do, or what's important, or what you're just blindly taking as their tradition.
Yes.
And forging a path. What are some of the issues that have come up with you?
It's such an interesting question, because it really, I think, is the moment when you have to look at yourself and say, does this resonate with me as a person, or is this a cultural given? And I think children actually help with that, because they're, when they grow up with two cultures, they're programmed to appreciate both and rather than either or. They will never say they're American, and they'll never say they're Italian. They'll say, we're American Neapolitans. They have both, and they don't judge one as better than the other. And they're able to include both cultures.
RadioGorgeous.com.
You are your true self at home, as opposed to, as Americans, we're taught, you know, the outside world.
Yes. It made me realize how important it was to me that my children behaved well and performed well in the eyes of society. Whereas for my husband, as an Italian, he couldn't care less about that. The important thing is who you are with the people who really matter, because in Neapolitan life, the people who really matter are your family. He said to me, well, you know, it would be much better if he misbehaved there, because then we wouldn't have to deal with
his
tantrums. Exactly. I've realized in Naples how we are hardwired to live in tribes. And I think in the United States, we've lost that with our extreme individualism. We are part of a group. And in Naples, the closeness of family really highlights that. And you realize these people really would do anything for their family.
But tell me about a typical Neapolitan day of eating and way of eating. I get up, I'm starving, obviously.
Yes. Well, breakfast is not a big deal in Naples. There's lots of coffee and sweets, a croissant or cookies, but it's not a big meal. not a lot of eating in between meals, as I talk about in the book. It's very ordinato. It's not messy eating, as she calls American eating. So they eat lunch at about 2, so a late lunch. And it's the biggest meal of the day, even bigger than dinner. And so there's a primo, so a pasta, and a vegetable, and a secondo, and then always fruit at the end.
And then what would dinner be and when?
Dinner would be probably, in the past, they would have primo, secondo, first, second. But in my husband's family now, after doing that big a lunch, they would have either a first course or a second course and vegetable and fruit.
Tell me your favorite Neapolitan meal.
Yes, I think I'm just, as they say in Italian, pastaiolo, a pasta addict. If I don't have pasta, I never fully de-hunger myself.
That's what she said, yeah.
I can't do it. There's no
the de-dramatization and de-hungerifying.
Exactly. So. But I think I would have to say that a simple ragù with rigatoni, short pasta. Now I say simple. It's
after
been cooking for 12
hours.
Exactly,
yeah.
For a day and a half, or whatever. But in terms of the ingredients, it's simple and it's cooked down to such a dense nectar that it's pretty incredible. And it has to be. It depends on the quality of the meat, the quality of the tomatoes, and the patience and love of the chef. And as my mother-in-law says, Ketrin, you can taste it if there's no love. You can taste it.
The book is filled with love, filled with a sense of learning to love yourself first and loving and being loved by your Neapolitan family.
Wonderful. I'm so glad.
Grazie mille.
Ah, grazie a te. Thank you so much, Donna.
Hey, mambo. Mambo Italiano. Hey, mambo. Mambo Italiano, go, go, go. You mixed up a Siciliano. All you Calabrese do the mambo like a crazy with it.
Radio Gorgeous.